Harrisburg to Greenville, Everett to Lansford, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, it has been a year and a half since the Supreme Court of the United States upheld the right of public employees not to be forced to pay dues or fees to labor unions. Are unions complying with the law? Keith Williams of Americans for Fair Treatment is here with the answer. Job growth in Pittsburgh and Allegheny County is lagging behind both the city of Philadelphia and the state average. Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi have an Allegheny Institute report. And statewide election of appellate court judges has resulted in uneven geographic representation. So-called merit selection robs voters of a say in who serves on those courts. Ashley Klingensmith from Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania has the solution on this week's Lincoln Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Keith Williams of Americans for Fair Treatment in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. An amendment to the state constitution that would change the way we select our lieutenant governor is halfway to being put before voters. Currently, voters for each party nominate a candidate for lieutenant governor in the primary, but then cast just one vote for governor-lieutenant governor combined in the general election. A proposal by Senator David Argall of Schuylkill County that would require each party's gubernatorial nominee to pick their running mate has won approval by both houses of the General Assembly. The proposed amendment must be passed again by both houses in the 2021-22 legislative session and then be approved by voters in a statewide referendum before going into effect. And a series of election law changes signed into law last year are creating uncertainty and adding to expenses, which must be funded by the state's 67 counties. Among the changes are no excuse absentee voting, the casting of absentee ballots right up until the polls close on Election Day, and allowing voters to register up to 15 days prior to the election rather than 30 days, as was previously the case. Adding to what could be massive confusion on Election Day, most counties will be rolling out new voting machines this year to comply with an executive order by Governor Tom Wolf requiring all voting systems to have a paper backup. All this will play out in what, historically, is the highest turnout year in the four-year election cycle. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. The case of Janus v. AFSCME upholding the constitutional right of public sector employees not to be required to belong to a union or pay any fees to a union as a condition of employment was a major victory for workers, but not all unions are following the law. To learn more, we turn to Keith Williams, who is Pennsylvania Director of Americans for Fair Treatment. Keith? Keith, before we start talking about the current status of worker rights relative to the Janus decision, for those in our audience who are unfamiliar with what the Janus decision is, and this was a case that was taken all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States, give us a little background on what the issue was that the court ruled on and what the court ruling ended up being.
Back to the initial plaintiff there, Mark Janus. Mm-hmm. Mark was a state worker in Illinois, and he was under the representation of AFSCME at the time and was basically forced. He did not necessarily want to be a member of AFSCME, but was forced to pay roughly 80% of full union dues to AFSCME because they represented him. Now, he didn't have a choice in who represented him. He had to take their representation, but he also had to pay them for the, you know, as they saw it, the benefits of membership and their representation. So he did not agree with their political stance on things and their politicking and their political activism. And so he felt that being compelled to pay them to subsidize their political speech essentially was a violation of his First Amendment rights. So took that to court. In essence, the Supreme Court ruled in his favor. And this, again, I think it's important to note, is specifically in the public sector. They ruled that any public sector union, their dues are inherently political because the public sector unions are always bargaining with the taxpayer, essentially. So no matter how you slice it, dues are political. So he won that argument in court. And the courts basically said that, yes, you cannot compel someone to subsidize your political speech against their will. So that's really what it was about, was basically saying, hey, look, if you don't want to be a member of the union, you shouldn't be forced to pay the union. And if you want to be a member, go for it, pay full dues. But it's within your rights to not be a member as well.
And of course, in the aftermath of that ruling, all the labor unions immediately complied with the law.
Sure.
I'm being a little facetious here.
Well, and it's – if you look back in history, I think it's true of any Supreme Court ruling. There's very few, if any, instances where the Supreme Court ruled and everyone just lined up and followed suit and followed the law. I mean, I think that was – you know, that was true in Brown v. Board of Education. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a long fight to get to where we are now. But yeah, there are ongoing issues. Certainly public sector unions, rather than serving the membership better in a lot of cases, are resorting to other tactics to try and coerce or compel people to stay in.
In terms of the labor union representation, if the union, like any other business, and we would view them as any other business, other than the special treatment that they get, like any business, if they were providing a value to their customers, their union members, would not the members want to stay and want to be represented? So isn't it incumbent upon the labor union to prove its value to its own members?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think to their credit, they have been trying to do that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, what I think is a little more telling is that things like maintenance of membership, which is a narrow window in which union members can get out. In a lot of cases, it's 10 or 15 day window every 4 years that they can leave. Provisions like that, my go-to phrase has been captivity is not solidarity. And while unions are preaching solidarity at the state and national level, I think it's pretty telling that they have to rely on these gimmicks and complicated resignation processes to keep people in. So it's to simplify the argument, it would be like you're living in a small town and you've got one pizza place within 50 miles. They don't have to sell you very good pizza because there's no competition. Mm-hmm. You're a captive audience. In Pennsylvania, we have exclusive representation. They don't have to give a very good product because you're forced to accept their product whether you want to or not.
But now workers do have the right to leave if they want. So Pennsylvania, we're going to talk here specifically about school districts. Mm-hmm. Pennsylvania has, 500 school districts?
Yep, 500.
Each of these school districts negotiates a contract with the teachers and others in their district. As we look at the wide range of this, and it's now been a year and a half or so since the Janus decision, are a number of the school districts falling in line and removing these provisions that prevent people from leaving or throwing roadblocks in their way? Or are they – is there solidarity among union leaders to fight this all across the board in all these districts?
Yeah. Well, teachers' unions are an interesting animal. And I think, you know, I'm saying this as a 21-year teacher myself. I think most teachers – it's fair to say most teachers view the union as their local. Mm-hmm. They don't necessarily think about the state and national so much. So when you talk about kind of the social pressures of being in a union, it's usually the local union membership that perpetuates the local union and union membership in general. So teachers generally see a lot of value in their local, except that less than 5% of their dues in a lot of cases go to the local. Mm. Most of it is getting funneled to the state and national. So it would be great if the compliance were there. But unfortunately, what's been happening is PSEA has instructed the locals to try to keep these fair share fees, these agency shop fees, which the Supreme Court ruled unconstitutional, in their contracts. So there are about 20 school districts in Pennsylvania right now that have renegotiated contracts since the Janus ruling, since the Supreme Court ruled fair share fees or agency shop fees, whatever you want to call them, unconstitutional. And these districts have actually gone on to continue including fair share fees as part of the contract. PSEA says, you know, basically this is not a big deal. These are unenforceable in the contract, but we'll just keep them in there. It's kind of a sleeper cell type of a move. We'll keep this unconstitutional provision in there. And the intent's pretty clear. There's actually a school district in Adams County, Bermudian Springs School District, where they had the audacity to actually say should the Janus decision be overturned, we're going to go ahead and reinstitute fair share fees. So it's, you know, the play is pretty clear. They're going to ignore the Supreme Court, keep the language in all 500 of these contracts with the design set on their intentions set on overturning the Supreme Court ruling down the road.
We are talking with Keith Williams, who is with Americans for Fair Treatment. And we're talking about the Janus ruling that upheld the rights of individual employees to not be forced to pay really any money whatsoever to a labor union if they don't want to. And the fact that particularly the Pennsylvania State Education Association, the PSEA, is not really complying with that. So you talked about Bermudian Springs, Keith, but can you give us a couple of other examples of where your organization has been involved with teachers who are finding that their constitutional rights are not being honored?
Again, there's about 20 school districts right now across the state that have renegotiated contracts. And those fair share fees are included in those contracts. Right now, again, because of the Supreme Court ruling, they can't enforce the fair share fees for those teachers that choose not to be members of the union. But certainly, they have every intention of taking advantage of the situation when they can and re-implementing them. So what I've been running into is less fair share fee issues now and more of the compliance with the language. What we're seeing is just they're trying to keep it in the contracts. There's been some representational issues. Maintenance of membership is an ongoing issue when people want to get out. And again, they don't make it easy. You know, it's whether it's PSEA or AFSCME or SEIU, I think the question everybody should be asking is, look, if it's truly so great to be in, why is it so hard to get out?
Has there been any litigation on that issue, or is that something that's still likely ahead?
That's likely ahead. I haven't encountered any yet, but again, you know, there's new things popping up every day, and it's the games we play. So.
And this will continue, I'm sure, to be an issue for the foreseeable future. Again, Keith Williams, who is the Pennsylvania Director of Americans for Fair Treatment. And Keith, tell us a little bit about your organization.
Americans for Fair Treatment is primarily an outreach to public sector workers to notify them of their rights. So the unions are supposed to advocate for workers in the workplace, but there really wasn't a place for workers to go when they needed to hold their unions accountable. And so that's really what we do is ensure that state workers, public sector workers have their rights to freedom of association respected by public sector unions.
And if folks want more information or to contact you, do you have a website?
Yeah, we do. AmericansForFairTreatment.org. And then we also have our other two project organizations, which are Free to Teach, F-R-E-E-T-O, teach.org, and freedomtoserve.org.
Again, Keith Williams from Americans for Fair Treatment. Keith, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Loman.
A look at employment trends finds Allegheny County lagging behind many other similar-sized counties throughout the country. Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi dig into the details on this Allegheny Institute report.
Hello, and welcome to the Allegheny Institute report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal. I'm Eric Montardi. Joining me today is the Executive Director of the Allegheny Institute, Frank Gamrat. We did wish Happy New Year to our listeners in our last installment, but now we are into 2020. So let's start with two big events that happened in 2020 here to start the year, both related to Allegheny County. Frank, your most recent policy brief, which is available at our website, www.alleghenyinstitute.org, talks about Allegheny County's economic performance going back for some time. Can you give our listeners some insights?
Absolutely. The Allegheny County Chief Executive was sworn in earlier in January, and in his speech he said, Allegheny County's economic growth since 2000 has been unprecedented. Let's start there. And so what we did was we just looked at household employment data from 2000 to the most recent, of course, 2019. Now, to catch listeners up on the minutiae of all this, data from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics is only available at the county level if you do the household survey as opposed to the employer payroll survey, which is only available to metropolitan statistical data. So we looked at the household survey where they call and say, hey, did you work this month for pay, yes or no, and then ask a few follow-up questions. But the bottom line is that since 2000, Allegheny County's household employment category only rose 2%. Now, okay, 2% over 19 years, monthly average, that's not all that terrific. Let's put it in some context. Statewide, it went up 6.5%. Philadelphia County, 14.2%. Now, I understand Philadelphia County is a city county, but it's our, you know, state neighbor, and so we can add them in there. We also looked at the U.S. average. It went up 15%. So when you think, hey, 2% is not bad, relatively speaking, it actually is pretty bad. And so we even looked at some other counties of comparable size to Allegheny. Cuyahoga, Hamilton County of Ohio, that's Cleveland's home base, Cincinnati's home base. Both of those had decreases to their employment level, so we bested them. But let's look at some better performing areas like Mecklenburg, North Carolina, which is Charlotte's home base. They're up 57.5% employment over the 19 years. Bejar County, which is San Antonio, Texas's home base, up 45%. Heck, even Marion County, Indiana, which is Indianapolis's home base, is up almost 8%. So, you know, when you look into some comparative cities, or sorry, comparative counties, Allegheny County does not look good in employment. Now, there's two other prongs to this little approach here. One, of course, is you have to have the labor force in which to draw. And so we looked at the labor force for these counties over the last 20 years. Allegheny County's labor force increase was 1.95%, again, around 2%. Statewide, 6.5%. Philadelphia, 13.8%. So again, not hanging in there with our neighbor in Pennsylvania, Philadelphia. The U.S. labor force has gone up 14.7%. So again, not faring too well when you start comparing this. Even if you look at, again, the counties we mentioned before, the two Ohio counties, Cuyahoga and Hamilton, both had decreases, so we did better than them, but we couldn't come close to what Mecklenburg did at 59%, or Bejar, Texas at 44%, or Marion County at 8%. Allegheny County has not done well economically since the turn of the millennium in 2000. So let's look at population. Obviously, labor force is a factor of population. Population in Allegheny County over that time frame is down almost 5%. Now, in all fairness, the bleeding has stopped a little bit since 2010, only down less than 0.5%. But again, over those nearly 20-year period, Pennsylvania's population is up 4%. Philadelphia is up 4.4%. We're just not doing really well in that area. So now, obviously, this becomes a chicken and egg problem. Population shows up if there's jobs to be had. And so your employment numbers will grow as a result of an increase in labor force, which would be the result of an increased population, if the opportunities were here. And get a little economics background on you. Labor force, of course, is comprised of those who are either unemployed or actually employed. Now, you're unemployed if you're also looking for work. So if you're retired or you're in an institutional setting like a school or a hospital, you would not be counted in the labor force. So the labor force is only those looking for work or those who are actually working. And we have just not kept up in the labor force area, and we've also not kept up in population. And of course, it goes back to looking at the regulatory practices of not just the state, but also in Allegheny County and its seat, Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh, over the last couple of years, has really gone off and done some rules and regulations that have not been very business friendly, like mandatory sick leave, trying to get unionization of custodial workers in private businesses, not just city businesses, city-owned stuff. And so it has not been very friendly, and I think you're starting to see that manifest itself at the county level, and the county has a lot of work to do before it can even think about growing and getting better. So that was one of the big issues that we had looked at based on comments from the county executive at the beginning of January. Eric, you noted that in your research, your most recent brief, again available on our website, that there was some news on property assessments coming out of the state Supreme Court, that they had a ruling on, I believe, a lower court case. Could you please expand on that, please?
Absolutely. And that talk about things that have been going on since it seems like the year 2000, right? There was a ruling in January from the Supreme Court on a class action lawsuit brought by someone who, and this is a familiar tale, not only in Allegheny County, but it's a familiar tale in other counties where we just have a situation where the state allows counties to not keep their assessments on property values up to date. That somebody buys a house, the assessed value is by some measure lower than that sale price, a taxing body looking at that based on criteria that they have, take it and appeal it, and then the appeals board typically will go ahead and raise it up to some higher level, closer to sales price. And then, of course, you have the people that bought the home that they feel like they've been singled out. They're caught off guard. They didn't know that the taxes were going to be this level. We've heard it, you know, many, many times. So basically, the case now is that these folks who bought the house, they may still win their appeal. It's at something now called the Board of Viewers, which is part of the Common Pleas Court in Allegheny County. This is like one step beyond the regular appeals board. But the class action lawsuit itself is kind of over and done with. It went through Common Pleas, then up to Commonwealth Court, and then Supreme Court didn't really even deliver opinion. They just issued a one-sentence ruling saying, we're just not going to hear the case. With that, Frank, I want to thank you for your research on the county's economic performance. And as we both mentioned, we always encourage you to visit our website, which is www.AlleghenyInstitute.org. And for Frank Gamera, this is Eric Montardi. This has been the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal.
Regional election of state appellate court judges and justices would bring more geographic balance to our statewide courts. So says Ashley Klingensmith of Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania, on this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
When we talk about the judiciary, people usually think of the big cases in federal courts that directly affect something on the national stage. But we often don't consider the critical impact courts, particularly state courts, have on state-level policy. Finding a good balance in the judiciary is critical. Judges must leave their personal biases at the door and carefully evaluate each case before them objectively and loyally applying the original intent of the state and federal constitutions. Similarly, they should not seek to legislate from the bench. Achieving a good policy outcome in the legislature does no good if judges inject their own opinions into the fray and overturn otherwise lawful statutes. Politicians and their constituents put a great deal of thought into the judges they select for the federal courts, particularly the courts of appeals. These are, of course, critical roles to fill. Accordingly, Americans for Prosperity has continued our engagement in our federal courts by recently endorsing now judges Lawrence Van Dyke and Patrick Bumate for the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. We also supported Justices Gorsuch and Kavanaugh in their confirmation battles by reaching millions on digital displays, reaching thousands by phone, sending 250,000 letters into senatorial offices, knocking on thousands of doors, and lobbying in district offices across the country, including each of Senator Casey's 7 Pennsylvania-based offices. But much of American litigation takes place in state, not in federal courts. They deserve a greater focus, and Americans for Prosperity intends to do so in 2020. This brings up obvious questions. What makes a good judge? How are they picked? Is there really such a thing as activist and restrained judges? Well, it's not all that helpful to think of judges as activist or restrained. A good judge will exercise his or her role no more and no less. This means not usurping the role of the legislature and writing the laws as they would have, and it means not invalidating laws enacted by the legislature or actions of the executive branch just because the judge disagrees with it. But a good judge will also not avoid his or her responsibility to interpret the Constitution as written and hold other government actors responsible when they overstep their authority. In Pennsylvania, state court judges are selected by popular election from the voters. While no selection process is perfect, this system is far preferable to many others used in other states. Voters deserve to have a voice in who administers the court system, and there must be accountability for judges who either exceed their authority or refuse to enforce the Constitution. A so-called merit selection system, which some would like to bring to Pennsylvania, would give power to a select few rather than the voters who are directly impacted by the decisions of the courts. In our key vote alert issued to members of the Pennsylvania House in May of 2019, we noted that House Bill 111 strips the electorate's ability to hold judges accountable away and replaces it with a system that empirical research has shown increases the likelihood of extreme judges being appointed to the bench. House Bill 111 creates a convoluted, unnecessary new system for judicial selection that takes power away from the people. This removes accountability for our judiciary while disempowering Pennsylvanians, and that is not a good outcome for anyone. In the next 3 years, we'll have two Supreme Court justices reach the mandatory retirement age of 75. We have an opportunity to begin conversations with our family, our friends, and our neighbors now about the virtues of a restrained judicial philosophy, the proper role of the courts, and the separation of powers. Let's start these conversations before an election year so that principled decisions are made by the voters of Pennsylvania. I'm Ashley Klingensmith, State Director with Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania. To find us on Facebook, search at PAAFP and on Twitter by searching at AFP Pennsylvania.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 25 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WXTU-FM in Bala Cynwyd, along with WBVP-AM and WMBA-AM in Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania. And it's time to talk about the 2020 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference. The Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is the premier gathering of grassroots conservatives every year here in the Keystone State. This year's conference will be held March 27th and 28th at the Radisson Penn Harris Convention Center in Camp Hill. Fox News contributor Jason Chaffetz will be the featured dinner speaker. Former U.S. Senator Rick Santorum will address the conference breakfast. There will be additional speakers, panel presentations, workshops, and networking. For complete information and to register for the 2020 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference, go to paleadershipconference.org. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. We'll be right back.